This is Audible.
Williams Audio presents the unabridged recording of I Am Watching You by Teresa Driscoll, performed by Elizabeth Nolden. July 2015. Chapter 1. The Witness. I made a mistake. I know that now. The only reason I did what I did was what I heard on that train. And I ask you, in all truthfulness, how would you have felt? Until that moment, I had never considered myself prudish or naive. Okay, so I had a pretty conventional, some might say sheltered, upbringing, but heavens, look at me now. I've lived a bit, learned a lot. Pretty average, I would argue, on the Richter scale of moral behaviour, which is why what I heard so shook me. I thought they were nice girls, you see. Of course, I really shouldn't listen in on other people's conversations, but it's impossible not to on public transport, don't you find? So many barking into their mobile phones while everyone else ramps up the volume to compete, to be heard. On reflection, I would probably not have become so sucked in had my book been better. But to my eternal regret, I bought the book for the same reason I bought the magazine with wind turbines on the cover. I read somewhere that by your 40s, you are supposed to care more about what you think of others than what they think of you. So why is it I am still waiting for this to kick in? If you want to buy Hello magazine, just buy it, Ella. What does it matter what the bored student on the cash desk thinks? But no. I pick the obscure environmental magazine and the worthy biography, so that by the time the two young men get on with their black plastic bin bags at Exeter, I am bored to my very bones. A question for you now. What would you think if you saw two men board a train, each holding a black bin bag, contents unknown? For myself, the mother of a teenage son whose bedroom is subject to a health and safety order, I merely think, typical. Couldn't even find a hold all, lads. They are loud and boisterous, skylarking in the way that so many men in their 20s do, only just making the train, with the plumped-up platform guard blowing his whistle in furious disapproval. After messing about with the automatic door, open, shut, open, shut, which they inevitably find hilarious beyond the facts, they settle into the seats nearest the luggage racks. But then, apparently spotting the two girls from Cornwall, they glance knowingly at each other and head further down the carriage to the seats directly behind them. I smile to myself. See, I'm no killjoy. I was young once. I watch the girls go all quiet and shy, one widening her eyes at her friend, and yes, one of the men is especially striking, like a model or a member of a boy band. And it all reminds me of that very particular feeling in your tummy. You know. So I am not at all surprised or in the least bit disapproving when the men stand up and the good-looking one then leans over the top of the dividing seats, wondering if he might fetch the girls something from the buffet, seeing as I'm going. Next there are name swaps and quite a bit of giggling, and the dance begins. Two coffees and four lagers later, the young men have joined the girls, all seated near enough for me to follow the full conversation. I know. I really shouldn't be listening, but we've been over this. I'm bored, remember? They're loud. So then, the girls repeat what I have already gleaned from their earlier gossiping. This trip to London is their first solo visit to the capital, a gift from their parents to celebrate the end of GCSEs. They are booked into a budget hotel, have tickets for Les Miserables, and have never been this excited. You kidding me? You really never been to London on your own before? Carl, the boy band lookalike, is amazed. Can be a tricky place, you know, girls. London, you need to watch yourselves. Taxi, not tube, when you get out of the theatre. You hear me? I'm liking Carl now. He's recommending shops and market stalls, also a club where he says they will be safe if they fancy some decent music and dancing after the show. He's writing down the name on a piece of paper for them. Knows the bouncer. Mention my name, okay? And then Anna, the taller of the two friends from Cornwall, is wondering about the black bags, and I am secretly delighted that she has asked, for I am curious also, smiling in anticipation of the teasing. Boys, so disorganized. What do you like, eh? But no. The two young men have just got out of prison. The black bags contain their personal effects. I can actually hear myself swallowing then, a rush of fluid suddenly filling the back of my throat, and my pulse now unwelcome percussion in my ear. The pause button is pressed, but not for long enough. Much too quickly, the girls are regrouping.
You having us on?
No, the boys are not having them on. They have decided to be straight with people, have made their mistakes and paid their dues, but refuse to be ashamed. Cards on the table, girls. Carl has served a sentence at Exeter Prison for assault, Anthony for theft. Carl was merely sticking up for a friend, you understand, and, hand on heart, would do the same again. His friend was being picked on in a bar, and he hates bullying. Me, I am struggling with the paradox, bullying versus assault, and do we really lock people up for minor altercations? But the girls seem fascinated, and in their sweet and liberal naivety, are saying that loyalty is a good thing, and they had a bloke from prison who came into their school once and told them how he had completely turned his life around after serving time over drugs. Covered in tattoos he was. Covered. Wow. Jail. So, what was that really like? It is at this point I consider my role. Privately, I am picturing Anna's mother toasting her bottom by her arga, worrying with her husband if their little girl will be all right, and he is telling her not to fuss so. They are growing up fast, sensible girls. They will be fine, love. And I am thinking that they are not fine at all. But Carl is now thinking that the safest thing for the girls would be to have someone who knows London well chaperoning them during their visit. Carl and Anthony are going to stay with friends in Vauxhall and fancy a big night to celebrate their release. How about they meet the girls after the theatre and try the club together? This is when I decide that I need to phone the girls' parents. They have named their hamlet. Anna lives on a farm. It's not rocket science. I can phone the post office or local pub. How many farms can there be? But now Anna isn't sure at all. No. They should probably have an early night so they can hit the shops tomorrow morning. They have this plan, see, to go to Liberty's first thing, because Sarah is determined to try on something by Stella McCartney and get a picture on her phone. Good girl, I am thinking. Sensible girl. Spare me the intervention, Anna. But there is a complication, for Sarah seems suddenly to have taken a shine to Anthony. There is a second trip to the buffet, and they swap seats on their return. Anna now sitting with Carl and Sarah with Anthony, who is telling her about his regrets at stuffing up his life. He only turned to crime out of desperation, he says, because he couldn't get a job, couldn't support his son. Son? It sweeps over me then. The shadow from the thatched canopy of my chocolate box life, me shrinking smaller and smaller into the shade as Anthony explains that he is fighting his ex for access, telling Sarah that there is no way he's going to have his son growing up, not knowing his dad. Don't you think that would be just terrible, Sarah, for him to grow up, not knowing his dad? Sarah is the one who is surprising me now. There's a catch in her throat as she says she thinks it's really cool that he cares so very much, because many young men wouldn't, would just walk away from the responsibility. I feel really awful now, us banging on about Stella McCartney. And the truth. At this point I have absolutely no idea about any of it anymore. What do I know? A woman whose son's only access battle involved an 18 certificate film at the local cinema. An hour of whispering follows, and I try very hard to read again, to take in the pluses of the quieter generation of wind turbines, but then Anthony and Sarah are off to the buffet again. More lager, I am thinking. Big mistake, Sarah. And this is when I decide. Yes, I will head to the buffet myself on the pretext of needing coffee, and in the queue or passing in the corridor will feign trouble with my phone. I will ask Sarah for help, hoping to separate her from Antony for a quiet word and give a little warning that she needs to step away from this nonsense, or I will be phoning her parents. Immediately, you understand me, Sarah? I can find out their number. Our carriage is three away from the buffet. I stumble into seats, passing through the second, bump, bump, bumping my thighs, and then feel for my phone in the pocket of my jacket as I pass through the automatic doors into the connecting space. And that's when I hear them. No shame. No attempt even to keep themselves quiet about it. Making out, loud and proud, in the train toilet, rutting in the cubicle like a pair of animals. I know it's them from what he's saying. How long it's been, how grateful he is. Sarah, oh Sarah. And yes, I admit it. I am completely shocked to the core of my very being. Hot with humiliation, furious, winded and desperate, more than anything on this planet to escape the noise. Also the shame of my naivety, my ridiculous assumptions. I stumble across the corridor to the next set of automatic doors and into the carriage, breathless and flustered in the scramble to put distance between myself and the evidence of my miscalculation. Nice girls? In the buffet queue, I am listening again to the pulse in my ear, as I wonder if someone else will have heard them by now, even reported them. And then I am thinking, report them? Report them to whom, Ella? Will you just listen to yourself? Other people will do precisely what you should have done from the off. They will mind their own. At which point, my emotions begin to change, and I am wondering instead how I came to be this out of touch, this buttoned up. This woman who evidently has not the first clue about young people, or anything, much. Into my head now, a kaleidoscope of memories, pictures torn around the edges, the magazines we found in our son's room. That night after the cinema, when we came home early to find Luke trying to override the Sky security to watch porn. So that on this wretched train, I find that I need very urgently to speak to my husband, to my Tony, to reset my compass. I need to ask him if the whole problem here is not with them, but with me. Am I altogether ridiculous, Tony? No, really, I need you to be honest with me. When we had that row over the Sky channels and Luke's magazines, am I the most terrible prude? Am I? I do try to ring him, actually, that night from the hotel after the conference session. I want to tell him how I did the sensible thing and moved to the other end of the train, minded my own. The girl's clearly quite streetwise enough. But he is out and hasn't taken his mobile, being one of the few who still thinks they give you brain cancer. And so I speak instead to Luke, and find that it calms me to hear him describe supper, a tagine from a recipe he downloaded on a new app. He loves to cook, my Luke, and I am teasing him about the state of the kitchen, betting he has used every appliance and pan on the property. Then it is the morning in the hotel. I so hate this sensation, that out-of-body numbness born of air conditioning, a foreign bed, and lack of discipline over the minibar. My hotel treat, a brandy or two, after a long day. It's barely 6:30 and I long for more sleep. 10 futile minutes and I give up, eyeing the sachets of sadness in the little bowl alongside the kettle. I always do this in hotel rooms, kid myself that I will drink instant coffee just this once, only to pour it down the bathroom sink. I stare at the line of empty miniatures, wincing as a terrible thought flutters into the room. I glance at the phone by the bed and feel a punch of dread, the familiar frisson of fear that I have done something embarrassing, something I am going to regret. I turn back to the row of bottles and remember that after the second brandy last night, I decided to phone directory inquiries to track down the girl's parents. I go cold momentarily at the thought of this, my memory still hazy. Did you actually ring? Think, Ella, think. I stare again at the phone and concentrate hard. Ah, yes, I'm remembering now, my shoulders relaxing as I finally see it. I was holding the phone, and then at the very point of dialing, I realized that I wasn't thinking straight, and not just because of the brandy. My motivation was skewed. I wanted to phone not because I was worried for the girls, but as a punishment, because I was angry at how Sarah had made me feel. And so I did the sensible thing. I put the phone back down, I turned out the light, and I went to sleep. Good. This is very good. The relief now so overwhelming that I decide by way of celebration that I will try the instant coffee after all. I flick on the kettle first, and then the television. And that is when it comes. The single moment, suspended at first, and then stretching, stretching, beyond this room, beyond this city. The moment in time in which I realize my life is never going to be the same again. Not ever. The sound is muted from the late-night film I watched with the subtitles on to spare disturbing the guests next door. But the picture is unmistakable. Beautiful. A photograph from her Facebook page, her green eyes glowing and her blonde hair cascading down her back. She's at the beach. I recognize St. Michael's Mount behind her. And somehow my body has zoomed backwards, through the pillow and the bedstead and the wall, until I am watching the screen from much further away. This screen that is scrolling putrid, awful words. Missing. Anna. Missing. Anna. The kettle screaming angry clouds onto the mirror while I am planning the calls in my head all at once. A black and terrible jumble of excuses. None of them good enough. To the police. To Tony. You have to understand that I was going to phone. Chapter 2. The Father. Henry Ballard sits in the conservatory, trying very hard to ignore the clattering in the kitchen. He knows that he should go to his wife, to help her, to console her, but he knows also that it will make no difference, and so is putting it off. The truth? He wants just a little longer like this, looking out on the lawn. In this strange space, the addition to the house that has never really worked, always too hot or too cold, despite all the blinds and the big dust magnet fan they had installed at ridiculous expense, he has managed somehow to drift into a state of semi-consciousness, a place in which his mind can roam beyond his body, beyond time, out into the garden where this very minute, in the early morning light, he is listening to them whispering in their den in the bushes. Anna and Jenny. It was their favorite place for a year, maybe two, when they were into that hideous pink phase. Pink duvets, pink Barbies, pink tent bought from some catalogue and filled with all manner of girly paraphernalia. He had always refused to go near the thing. Now he wanted more than anything in the world to forget the milking and the hay, the VAT forms and the bank, and to float out there and make a little fire to cook sausages for their breakfast. Proper camping, like he promised to do so many times, but never did. Now an almighty crash from the kitchen brings him back inside. She's picking up tins from the floor, a collection of Bannum baking cases in all manner of sizes and shapes. What on earth are you doing? Plum slices. Oh, for Christ's sake, Barbara. Anna's favourite. A sort of flapjack with spiced stewed plums through the middle. He can smell the cinnamon. The spice jar is tipped over on the kitchen surface, the pungent spill a neat tiny hill. Oh, Barbara. He watches her picking up all the tins, her hands trembling, and simply cannot bear it. And so, instead of helping and trying to be in any way kind or even decent, he goes into his study and sits by the phone so that 5, maybe 10 minutes later, he is the first to see the police car pull up again on the drive outside. Something terrible wrenches in his stomach then, and he actually thinks for a moment of barricading the door, a ridiculous image of all the hallway furniture piled up high so that they cannot come in. There are two of them this time, a man and a woman, the man in a suit and the woman in uniform. By the time he is in the hall, his wife is standing in the kitchen doorway in her apron, wiping her hands dry over and over and over. He turns to look at her for just a moment, and her eyes plead with him and with God and with justice. He opens the door. Anna and Jenny rushing in with their school bags and tennis rackets, chucking them all onto the floor. Relief. 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 Then for real. Their faces say it. Have you found her? The man in his creased high street suit just shakes his head. This is the family liaison officer, PC Kathy Bright. We talked about her on the phone. He can say nothing. Mute. Is it all right if we come in, Mr. Ballard? A nod. All he can muster. In the study, they all sit, and there is a strange shushing noise, flesh on flesh, as his wife rubs her palms together, and so he reaches out to take her hand, to stop the noise. As we said before, the police in London, the Metropolitan team, they are doing everything they can. They fast-track the case, given Anna's age, the circumstances. They are in contact with us constantly. I want to go to London, to help Mr. Ballard. We discuss this. Your wife needs you here, and there are things we need help with here too. It is better for now, please, if we can concentrate on gathering all the information that we need. If there is any news, anything at all, I promise you that you will be told and we will arrange transport immediately. So, has Sarah remembered anything? Said anything more? We would like to speak to her, if we could just speak to her. Sarah is still in shock. It's understandable. There is a specialist team on hand and her parents are with her now. We are all trying to get what information we can. Officers in London are going over all the CCTV footage from the club. I still don't get it. Club? What were they doing in a club? There was nothing in the plan about any club. They had tickets for Les Miserables. We expressly said that... And there is a new development which may throw some light on that, Mr. Ballard. The sound his throat makes as he tries to clear it seems too loud. Guttural. Gross. A witness has come forward. Someone who was on the train. Phlegm. In his throat. Witness? What do you mean, witness? Witness to what? I'm not understanding. The two police officers exchange a look, and the woman moves to the chair next to Barbara. The detective does the talking. A woman who was sitting near Anna and Sarah on the journey has phoned in after the police appeal. She says she overheard the two girls striking up an acquaintance with two men on the train. What do you mean, acquaintance? What men? I'm not following you. His wife is now gripping his hand more tightly. From what we heard, Mr. and Mrs. Ballard, it appears that Anna and Sarah may have become friendly with two men who are known to us. Men? What men? Men who had just got out of prison, Mr. Ballard. No. No. She must be mistaken. There's no way, absolutely no way. The police in London are going to try to speak to Sarah some more about this, urgently, and to this witness. As I say, we just need to piece together as much detail as we can about what happened before Anna went missing. It's been hours and hours. Yes. They're sensible girls, officer. You understand that? Good, sensible girls, brought up right. We would never, never have let them go on the trip if we didn't... Yes, yes, of course. And you must try very hard to stay positive. Like I say, we are doing everything we possibly can to find Anna, and we will keep you informed every step of the way. Kathy can stay with you, answer any questions you may have. I'd just like to have another look at Anna's room, if I may. We are hoping there may be a diary, have a look at her computer, that sort of thing. Could you show me, Mr. Ballard, while Kathy perhaps makes a cup of tea for your wife? Yes? He isn't listening now. He is thinking that she didn't want them to go. His wife. She said they were too young. It was too far. Too soon. He was the one who spoke up for the trip. Oh, for heaven's sake, Barbara, you can't baby them forever. The truth? He felt Anna needed to step away from the apron strings. Away from the plum slices. But it wasn't only that. Dear God. What if they found out that it wasn't only that? Chapter 3. The Friend. In a stuffy twin room of the inappropriately named Paradise Hotel in London, Sarah can hear her mother's voice whispering her name and so keeps her eyes resolutely shut. It is a different room now, identical, but on a different floor. The one in which she unpacked with Anna remains off limits, though Sarah cannot understand why. Anna did not go back there. Did they not believe her? She did not come back here, okay? In this room there is still a horrid, ill-defined smell. Something that reminds her of the back of a cupboard, hide-and-seek as a child. With her eyes closed, Sarah wishes she could play the game right now. Ignore the smell and the temperature, her mother and the police, and play hide-and-seek. Yes. The time-slip version in which Anna is drying her hair around now, the tongs already hot for straightening afterwards, blabbing on above the drone of the motor about what they should do today, which shop they should visit first. And was Sarah serious about trying on the Stella McCartney range because the assistant would be able to tell from their clothes that they weren't actually going to buy anything? Anna. Sweet, infuriating Anna. Too skinny. Too beautiful. Too... Are you awake, love? Can you hear me, darling? Sarah, facing away from her mother still, opens her eyes and winces at the light fighting through the chink in the curtains to shape a triangle on the wall. She had lain on the bed fully clothed, refusing to get under the covers, so sure there would be news by now. Any minute. They would find her. Any minute. I'm glad you managed to drop off, love. Even just an hour. I've made us some tea. I don't want anything. Just a sip. Two sugars. You need to get something inside you. Some sugar. I said I can't face it. All right? Her mother is in the same trousers as yesterday, but a fresh blouse now, and Sarah is thinking it is both typical and somehow inappropriate that she thought to bring a clean blouse. Your father's arrived. He's downstairs. He's been with the police, mostly. They want to speak to you again. When you feel... I've told them everything I can remember already, hours of it, and I don't want to see my father. You shouldn't have called him. Sarah and her mother lock eyes. Look, I know it's difficult, darling, you and your dad, but the thing is he does care, and they've had some call, the police, that they want to talk to you about, after the coverage on the telly. Call? Yes, from some woman on the train. Woman? I don't know what you're talking about. What woman? Sarah can feel the same gaping hole in her stomach that she felt in those first terrible hours while she waited with the police for her mother, while she was still woozy from the booze, disorientated. Where are you, Anna? Where the hell are you? Trying to give the officers just enough detail to make them take it all seriously, but not enough to... She gets up quickly now, feeling the crumple of her linen shirt against her waist as she moves, fussing with the hairbrushes, makeup bags and other junk on the dressing table. Have you got the remote? I need to see the news. What they're saying. What are they saying? I don't think that's a good idea, Sarah. Drink your tea. I'll tell your dad you're awake, that they can come up now. I'm not speaking to them again. Not yet. Look, darling, I realize this is awful. For you, for all of us. Her mother is moving across the room now. But they'll find her, love. I'm sure they will. She probably went off to some party, isn't afraid she's in trouble. She put her arm around Sarah's shoulders, the mugs of tea now positioned amid the chaos of the dressing table, but Sarah shrugs her off. Are Anna's parents here? Not yet, I don't know. I don't know what's been decided about that. The police wanted to check some things with them in Cornwall. What things? Computers or something, I don't know. I don't exactly remember, Sarah. It's all been a blur. They just want to get all the information they can to help with this, with the search. And you think I don't? You think I don't feel bad enough? No one's blaming you, love. Blaming me? So why say blaming me if no one's blaming me? Sarah, love, don't be like this. They're going to find her. I know they are. I'll ring downstairs. No! I need you to leave me alone, all of you. I need you to just leave me alone now. Sarah's mother takes her mobile from her pocket and is just feeling around for her glasses when there is a tap at the door. That'll probably be them now. It is the same detective as before, but with a different woman police officer this time, and Sarah's father alongside. So, is there any news? Sarah's mother begins to raise her body from the chair, but slumps back down as their heads shake a no in stereo. Did you manage to rest, Sarah? Feel okay to talk some more now? It is the woman police officer. I wasn't drunk when we spoke before. I wasn't drunk. No. The adults all look from one to the other. We've had a look at the CCTV, Sarah, from the club. It is the detective's voice now, firmer. Some of the cameras weren't working, unfortunately, but there are some things we're not quite understanding, Sarah. Also, we've had a call from a witness.
A witness?
Yes, a woman on the train. She feels it instantly. The frisson, the giveaway, the cooling as the blood shifts, draining from her face. 1 year on, July 2016. Chapter 4, The Witness. I never deluded myself. I always knew what this week would be like. One part of me longing for it, the slim hope the anniversary coverage might kickstart things again for the investigation. But the other part, pure dread. People giving me that look again. That woman, do you remember? The woman who didn't say anything. On the train, do you remember? When that girl disappeared. Christ, is it a year ago already? I do still want it. The reconstruction on crime catchers for the family. That poor mother. I just don't want to be a part of it. You can understand that, can't you? I mean, I didn't mind them asking. Although Tony went ballistic when the police phoned up. Surprised they had the gall. You leak her name, you let everyone judge her, and you think she wants to be on your television program. He still insists it was a deliberate leak, the press getting my name. We have no proof, and I have got to the point, to be frank, where I'm not sure I care one way or the other. All I know is that I cannot bear the thought of everyone turning up all over again, raking it up all over again, judging me. Hating me. Even loyal customers in the shop giving me that slightly odd look, deliberately not mentioning it. The official version from the police press office is that there was no leak. They merely mentioned to a few reporters that the witness on the train was attending a conference. But they must have said what kind of conference, otherwise how did the press know I was a florist? Whatever. Some of the press pack checked out the various floristry events, worked through the list of delegates from Devon and Cornwall, and eventually landed at our door. I still go cold, thinking about it. Of course, if I'd been smarter, they would have had no way of confirming it. If I had thought to say, I don't know what you're talking about, they would have had to leave it at that. But I didn't. I know this is going to sound completely stupid, but what I said in my complete disorientation on the doorstep was, who gave you my name? Why the hell did you say that? Was the first thing Tony asked. Jesus, Ella, you gave it to them on a plate. But I didn't, not really. I didn't let any of the reporters in. I didn't give them any quotes, I swear, but they still took my picture, and they phoned and phoned and phoned until we had to change the number. Harassment, Tony called it. Hasn't she been through enough? Bless him. My sweet, sweet man. And then things turned really nasty. Horrid stuff on social media. Until, in the end, we had to close down the shop for a bit. But here's the thing. As horrid as it all was, I still don't think I've been through enough. She's still gone. That beautiful girl. Most probably dead. Almost certainly dead. Although from what I hear, her poor mother still clings to the hope that she's alive. And can you blame her? I probably would too. The police liaison officer for Crime Catchers told me that Mrs. Ballard has given a really harrowing interview. I'm not even sure I can watch. Anna's mother has spent the last year collecting all this information on missing girls who have eventually turned up years later, You know, held captive by some loon, brainwashed, and then finally escaped. They had to cut all that out of the interview, apparently, as it's not the police's focus at all. They obviously think Anna is most probably dead. This is about finding a killer, not finding a loon with a girl in his basement. Out of sensitivity, they have kept all of Mrs. Ballard's stories about Anna as a little girl, all her hopes and her dreams. That's apparently just the sort of thing that makes people phone in with new information. But it's all about finding the two men, finding the body, I suppose. Makes me go cold to think of that. And this is where Tony gets really angry. His take is if the police hadn't been so slow in putting out the appeal to trace Carl and Anthony after I tipped them off, then maybe they would have stopped them doing a bunk, most probably abroad. As far as I can tell, the delay was something to do with Sarah. The police are diplomatic, but, putting two and two together, it seems at first she denied ever meeting them. The men on the train said I was a fantasist. It was only when they went over all the CCTV footage and finally found a couple of shots of them getting off the train together, and also outside the station, that the police even put their pictures out. Too late. But that, of course, is where it all goes wrong, and it all comes back to me. If I had phoned in a warning in the first place, if I had stepped up, stepped in. You are not to think like that. You can't take the world on your shoulders. You did nothing wrong, nothing, Ella. It was those men, not you. You can't go on blaming yourself. Can't I, Tony? And I'm not the only one, now. The first postcard came a few days ago. At first I was so shaken when I read it, I had to go straight to the bathroom. Vomited. I can't explain why I felt so very scared. Shock, I suppose. Because initially it seemed so threatening, so darned nasty. And then when I finally calmed down and thought it all through, I suddenly realized who'd sent it. And with that came a mixture of relief and crippling guilt. To be perfectly honest with you, I probably deserve it. It was just anger, not a real threat, just lashing out. That first postcard was inside an envelope, a black card, with letters cut out of a magazine. Why didn't you help her? It was just like you see on a television drama, and not even very well done. Still sticky to the touch. I was stupid. I ripped it up and put it in the bin because I didn't want Tony to see. I knew he would phone the police and I didn't want that. Them round here. The press round here. All that craziness all over again. It took me a while to process it properly. To start with, I thought it was just another random nutter, but then I thought, hang on a minute, the anniversary appeal hasn't even been on the telly yet. The truth is, the story has been forgotten. Until the programme tonight, no one else will have given it a second thought. That's how it works, why it's so difficult for the police. It's all people talk about one minute, and then the next, everyone forgets. Then today, another card arrived. Black, again, with a nastier message. Bitch, how do you sleep? So that I see it even more clearly now. This is my fault. This is to pay me back, not just for what I didn't do for Anna, but for going down there in the summer. I know exactly who the postcards are from now. Chapter 5. The Father. Henry Ballard checks his watch and whistles for Sammy. In the distance, he can see smoke just emerging from one of the holiday lets, a former barn that was once his father's destination at this same time of an evening, the final check of the livestock before supper. Henry still takes the same stroll each night himself, but with a quiet sorrow now. Anna's voice haunting him as he walks. You disgust me, Dad. Henry closes his eyes and waits for the voice to quieten. By the time he opens his eyes, there is a stronger curl of smoke from the chimney ahead. It all made economic sense, of course. The conversions, It became Barbara's favourite phrase, and the bank's too. Makes good economic sense, Henry. The agricultural success story that was Ladbroke Farm had been four generations in the making. It survived the rise and fall of local mining. It survived the changing tastes of the consumer market. It won rosettes for rare breeds. It even branched out into daffodils at one point. But the segue from full working farm to what his colleagues now dismiss as still playing at it, H, took but a blink. Tourism is the business he is in now, not farming. And yes, it makes absolute sense financially. One set of barns was converted and sold to pay off all the outstanding loans more than a decade back. A second set is now rental properties, and that is more than enough income on top of the tea shop and campsite, and certainly more regular profit than his father or his grandfather had dared hope for. The truth, they put in the slog, his ancestors. They paid off the bulk of the debts to the banks with blood, sweat and tears too. And him, what has he done? He has reaped the rewards. There isn't an evening that Henry Ballard has not felt wretched about that. So yes, he is still playing at it, messing about on the fringe with his sheep, barely worth the feed, and his tiny rare breed beef herd. He has taken the same walk with a heavy heart for years, and now, since Anna? Henry winces again at the memory of his daughter beside him in the car. You disgust me. So, what's left now? He says out loud, as Sammy nuzzles his hand, amber eyes turned up to check his master's. The dog still sits under Anna's chair every night during supper. Unbearable. Henry pats Sammy's head, then sets off for the farmhouse. He is dreading the evening ahead, but has promised Barbara they will watch the anniversary appeal together, so he must not be late. They have talked at length about how to handle this, worrying about what is best for Jenny, who has perhaps coped the worst of all, the sister without a sister. Only 18 months between the girls, so sweet and so close, especially when they were little. Oh, sure, there were fights, too, the usual sibling rivalry, but they were always friends by bedtime, often choosing to share a room, even though there were bedrooms to spare. Henry thinks for a moment of how he used to peek through their door to check on them last thing at night, all arms and legs in pink pyjamas, curled up in a double bed. That punch to his gut again. Jenny is still not sleeping. Barbara is still not sleeping. He has no idea how they are all supposed to manage it, this TV appeal. The glare of the spotlight all over again. An invitation to the studios in London was declined as out of the question. Barbara would never have coped with a live interview. No. Henry put his foot down, not least because time around the police made him so very nervous. So all the filming had been done in advance at the house. They had dug out an old video, too, from when Anna was tiny. He pauses, clenching his fist at the memory of the camera in his hand, Barbara calling directions in the background. A gaggle of friends round for a birthday treat, all of them in fancy dress, cowboys and fairy costumes. A huge chocolate cake with candles. Get some shots of her blowing out the candles, Henry. Make sure you don't miss a shot of the candles. He thinks of that other version of his wife, Barbara beaming and bustling, at her happiest when the house was full of children and noise and chaos. Henry clears his throat and leans down to stroke Sammy's head again, feeling the familiar wave of connection. Man to dog. Man and dog to land. So, yes, they agreed to release some of the birthday video, as the police said moving pictures tended to bring in more calls, which was, of course, the whole point. This first anniversary was a key opportunity, they were told, to resurrect interest in the case, to bring in new leads, to try to find the men from the train. But he and Barbara worry very much about the strain on Jenny. She is also in the clip, chosen by the TV producers, smiling alongside her sister, and Barbara and Henry had sat down and made it absolutely clear that if Jenny were even the tiniest bit uncomfortable, they could say no and come up with something else, or ask if her image could be blanked out in some way. But what had broken Henry was how their elder daughter reacted. It was as if she suddenly saw this light go on, a window of opportunity in the wretched grind of guilt and helplessness. Suddenly her eyes were shining, and she was saying that of course she didn't mind people seeing her in a fairy costume with wings. Dear God, if it might help them find Anna. And then she was off to her room, shouting that he was to follow her. There were loads of old pictures in boxes in one of the cupboards. She would dig them out. And could he call the police? Right now, Daddy. Loads of really great pictures. Do you remember when we used to fool about in those automatic booths? The gang. Me, Sarah and Anna, and Paul and Tim. She found an example, the five of them pulling faces, and held it out to him. Henry sucks in the cold air as he remembers Anna in the center of her friends and closes his eyes. You disgust me. He had guessed the police wouldn't want the pictures, and they didn't. They just wanted the film. And when he told poor Jenny that the police were very grateful, and he and Mummy were too, for all the time she had put in, finding the other pictures, her eyes had changed right back to how they always looked now. Sort of only half there. Come on then, Sammy. Time to do this. Taking his wellies off in the boot room, Henry can hear his wife calling up the stairs.
Now are you sure you don't want to watch it with us, Jen? Down here? Daddy and I really don't like the idea. Oh, hang on, I can hear. Daddy's back.
He walks in his socks through to the kitchen.
Great, good. Henry, I've set it ready on the right channel and it's all set to record, too. The producer has been on from the studio and they're going to ring us to let us know about the number of calls.
Good. That's good.
Jennifer is still saying that she wants to watch it in her room. I don't feel at all happy about that, Henry. Will you try talking to her again?
If you like. But I spoke to her this morning, love, and...
The thing is, she doesn't have to watch it at all if she doesn't want to. I've told her that. But if she does, I don't want her to be on her own. I don't see why she won't be with us. We should be together for this. Don't you think we should be together? As a family, watch it together.
Henry wonders if he should say it. The obvious, that they are no longer a family. He examines his wife's face very closely and lowers his voice to a whisper. Jenny doesn't want to have to see our faces, darling. He means hers. Barbara's.
Our faces?
Barbara's expression changes as she turns the words over for a moment. She looks away to the mirror in the hall and then quickly back at him.
Is that what she said?
She didn't have to, love. Henry continues to watch his wife very, very closely as she processes this properly. He makes himself look at her, right in the eye. He knows exactly why it is so difficult for Jenny to do this, because he finds it so very difficult these days himself, to witness the depth of it all, written there, dark and dreadful at the very back of Barbara's eyes, all day, every day. No matter how hard she tries to dress it all up for Jenny with hope and smiles, with her scrapbook cuttings of the lost and found, and her endless baking.
But you'll still talk to her before the program?
She's looking down at the floor now. Henry steps forward and kisses his wife on the forehead. It is a kiss of duty, and he does not touch her at the same time, for he knows the rules, their limits, their physical life on hold, or maybe gone forever. I'll just wash my hands and then, yes, I'll talk to her. Jenny is sitting on the floor of her room, surrounded by bits of paper. Magazines also, and old photo albums, too. Mummy wanted me to have another word. Henry scans the albums. Lots more photographs of the two sisters growing up, matching bridesmaid dresses in one, their first day at big school together. Most of the recent pictures are stored digitally, of course, but Jenny printed off a lot of favourites after her laptop crashed one year, and she lost the pictures from a whole summer. They'd already been wiped from the camera. Irretrievable.
It's all right. I've asked Paul and Sarah and Tim to come over. Is that okay? I mean, Mum's right. It might feel too upsetting to watch it on my own, but I can't sit with Mummy. I just can't.
Oh, Right. I'd better have a word.
Goodness. He checks his watch.
It's just that your mother might not feel comfortable with so many other people in the house this evening.
Oh, come on, Dad. These aren't other people. They're my friends.
Henry presses his lips together. There is still an hour and a half until the program is due to start. He takes a deep breath, trying to weigh up his own response before dealing with his wife's. Barbara will cater. Sandwiches and cakes and the like. Fussing. Absent-mindedly, he looks at his watch again. Who knows? Maybe it will actually help Barbara to have something to fuss over. A distraction. He is surprised that Sarah's mother, Margaret, does not want her at home to protect her. It has been hard for Sarah. A lot of unanswered questions. Still, no one quite understands the story of how the friends became separated in London, and some people have been pointing fingers. Privately, Henry is not entirely disapproving. Better for people to be focusing on Sarah. Downstairs, Barbara loads the last of the dishes into the dishwasher as he explains the new turn of events.
Oh, right. I see.
So, what do you think? Are you okay with this? With a house full, I mean. I realize Jenny should have discussed this with us first, but I didn't like to criticize. Not today.
Barbara wipes her hands on her apron and undoes the bow at the back. I'm not sure it's a good idea, Henry. That's my gut instinct. I mean, I know how close they all are.
Were.
She draws herself up, sucking in a breath.
Henry waits, and they let the moment hang between them. No one knows what tense to use.
But everyone's been so on edge lately.
She's lifting the apron loop over her head.
Jenny included. I'm not sure it will be helpful. Not for Jenny. I don't want anything kicking off. Not tonight.
It seems to be what Jenny wants. Henry is still staring at his wife.
I'm not sure she knows what she wants any more than we do.
She sighs.
Oh, stuff it. Say yes.
Barbara suddenly throws the apron onto the kitchen work surface. It's going to be horrible, whoever is in the house. The conversation is interrupted by a thud upstairs. Jenny's footsteps stamping around her bedroom above the kitchen, all the time shouting into her mobile. Most of it incoherent, until they hear,
God, no! Please! No!
Then a terrible noise of crashing and glass smashing as objects are apparently hurled around the room.
Chapter 6. The Witness.
You need to take this straight to the police.
That's out of the question.
I'm sorry? I'm thrown. I take the latest postcard back, all the while examining Matthew Hill very closely. I had not expected this reaction. I have wrapped this new card in a plastic wallet taken from Luke's school folder. One of those very slippery plastic wallets with holes pre-punched. Dangerous things. I slipped on one left on the floor once and bashed my shoulder really badly. The latest message arrived, like the others, in a plain dark envelope with a printed address label. But this one is even odder and just a little more threatening. Black background again, with the lettering stuck on. Karma. You will pay. To start with, I thought it very strange, the link with Buddhism or yoga or whatever. Weren't they about gentleness and kindness and forgiveness? But then I looked it up online and read about karma being interpreted by some people as a kind of natural justice or comeuppance, bad consequence for bad action. And I started to go a bit cold. I have to make this stop.
I thought you investigated this kind of thing. That's what private investigators do.
I regret the mild sarcasm, but I am tense, still staring Matthew Hill right in the eyes, just a little disorientated, too. His advert made it sound straightforward. Exeter-based PI, ex-police. Neat. Simple. I had imagined I would say what I wanted, and he would do it. But this is how he earns his living. Like someone coming into my shop. Birthday bouquet, please. Certainly. Look, I've been following the coverage. This is new evidence. The girl's still missing, And when there's a live inquiry, I have this rule that I don't... Trust me, Mr. Hill, this is not evidence. And you know this because... I pause for a moment, not at all sure how much I should share. Look, I know who this is from. It's from the girl's mother, Barbara Ballard. She's very upset with me. No, that's an understatement. She is beyond upset, and who can blame her? I certainly don't. I brought this entirely on myself. When the first postcard arrived, I admit I considered telling the police. For a moment it really shook me, frightened me. We had quite a lot of hassle after my name was leaked, and I thought it was more of the same. But I realize now what this is really about. There have been three, and so I just need you to gently warn her off, please, to stop this. Otherwise my husband will find out, and then he will insist we go to the police, which I don't want for her. She's got enough to deal with. Well, I'm afraid I'm with your husband on this. You could well be wrong. Look, she comes to my shop, twice so far, just watches me through the window. She doesn't know that I know, obviously. Right, so when did this start? His expression has changed. We're talking in confidence, yes? Of course. Good, because I'm not reporting this either. It really is my own fault, and I don't just mean about the train. I went down there, you see, to Cornwall last summer, to see the mother. My husband warned me not to, and it turns out he was right. It was completely stupid of me. I see that now. Just one in a long line of mistakes I've made over this whole terrible business. The worst, as you will be well aware, was not phoning, not warning that poor family in the first place. You didn't hurt the girl, Mrs. Longfield. Weren't there a couple of guys in the picture, key suspects, just out of Exeter? Yes, but that makes me feel worse rather than better, Mr. Hill. Matthew, please call me Matthew. Matthew, my husband says the same thing over and over, that this is not my fault, but I'm afraid it doesn't make me feel any better, and I can't bear that they haven't found her. There is a hissing noise suddenly from an adjoining room. I glance to the door across the office, which is ajar, and Matthew Hill stands suddenly, his expression softening. I tell you what, would you like a coffee, Mrs. Longfield? I make a pretty good cappuccino. Ella, and yes, please, it smells as if you know what you're doing. I feel a smile, relaxing a little, my shoulders changing shape. I am rather fond of good coffee. Espresso machine, imported beans, my own mix. It's a weakness. Mine too. I take a deep breath. Sorry to be so spiky before. I was quite nervous coming here. Most people are. His voice trails off as he disappears into what I presume is a flat alongside the office. He is gone for quite some time, eventually reappearing with a tray bearing two coffees plus a jug of foaming milk. I nod to the offer of milk. So, tell me some more about this mother, about your visit to Cornwall, all of it. No holding back on me. All right. I don't know how closely you followed the case, but there was an awful kerfuffle with the press when they found out that I was the witness on the train. The Nationals got terribly excited, sent all their feature writers down, big moral dilemma headlines, what would you have done, and all that. Yes, I saw the stories. He leans forward in his chair, sipping at the drink. All very unpleasant. I have a flower shop. It was so awful we had to shut it for a month and close our social media accounts too. I found I couldn't face people. Friends were very understanding, but some people were a bit odd. Even regular customers. You could tell from the way they looked at me. I'm sorry. The fallout from cases is underestimated. People can be very unkind. Yes, well. Tony, my husband, was completely furious. Like I say, he is very protective. A sweet man. And he was furious that my name got out. And how exactly did that happen? We were never entirely sure. I was at a floristry conference in South London, training and business modelling. Officially, the police insist that the press just got lucky and put the jigsaw together by tracing me as one of only two people on the course from Devon. But Tony suspects a deliberate leak to boost press interest in the case. Matthew pulls a face. So You do think that's possible? I ask.
Wouldn't like to say. It seems highly unlikely. They wouldn't want to put you in danger.
Danger? So you really think I might be in danger now?
Sorry, I didn't mean